I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're going to be talking about how the press has treated Donald Trump and how Donald Trump has treated the press. We're going to have two really good guests with us, and I'm sure many, many phone calls. Margaret Sullivan will be joining us at the top of the hour, media columnist for The Washington Post. She was the New York Times public editor before that, and before that, the chief editor of the Buffalo News, her hometown paper where she started as an intern. A little bit later in the hour, Roy Peter Clark, who has been with the Poynter Institute, its first full-time faculty member, dean, vice president, and senior scholar. He wrote an interesting piece about, well, it's a long story, but you'll have to hear the story about Jeb Bush. But he asks Jeb Bush to please help him understand why Donald Trump is the next president of the U.S. and Jeb Bush is not. Margaret Sullivan has written a piece, and it's a call to action for journalists covering President Trump. She writes, among other good sentences in a recent article in the Post, "One thing is certain, in the presumptive era of President Trump, journalists are going to have to be better, stronger, more courageous, stiffer spined than they ever have been." We'll be welcoming phone calls for both guests for the whole hour and love to hear what you have to say. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Margaret, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's very nice to be with you and your audience.
Thanks. It's great. I love the name Margaret. If I were to name myself, it would have been Margaret. Margaret.
Oh, well, I would have gone with Kathleen and gone with Kate. So there you go.
Oh, okay. There you go. I guess we have to be happy with what we have. You know, we had a guest on, and I didn't think I'd go this direction, but it's interesting what he said. He was a historian of the Republican Party, and he was talking to somebody on the transition team last night, and he said, you know, the press isn't getting some of these stories about the transition and what's going on here because nobody in the press, himself included, ever thought that Donald Trump was going to win, so they didn't try to understand what was going with him as completely as maybe the press should. There should be somebody who's understanding the transition team.
Well, there's no question that we're doing some self-examination after the election, all of us who are in the media or the press, because I think we fail to fully understand the strong forces that would, in fact, elect Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think many people throughout the country, certainly not everyone, but many people thought that Hillary Clinton would, in fact, be elected president, and that was kind of the thinking going into it. So we're having a little bit of a reckoning now, and your caller, you know, may have a point there. But I think at this point, you know, what we really need to do is buckle down and be as fair and as accurate as possible, but also to realize that we have a very unusual candidate here and one who has really made his dislike and scorn for the role of the press to be a centerpiece of his campaign. So it's going to be quite a challenge to cover the Trump administration in the right way.
Well, and as you write, and this should give everybody pause, we're in a world in which people at his rallies wore T-shirts, he reminded us, that read "Tree Rope Journalist, Some Assembly Required." It's been seen at Trump rallies, heartily approved of on social media. People from your paper, The Washington Post, were kicked out of being able to cover Donald Trump. He's called out journalists, and they've had to get security guards because of what he said. I mean, it hasn't been the press is an important part of our democracy. What we've been hearing is quite the opposite, and those are scary things that have been happening.
They are, and, you know, I think while there's a lot of anti-press sentiment out there, I'm still hopeful that most Americans and most American citizens realize that we need a strong, independent press that actually isn't, you know, in it just for themselves, but is there to represent the public. And I know, because I get a lot of mail from readers of all kinds, that some people did not feel well represented by the press during this election cycle. And that's something that we do have to, you know, think about and come to terms with and do better with, but not get so involved, I think, in, you know, beating ourselves up that we don't do our jobs, which is really to hold powerful people accountable. And that's really our main role.
You have written that you hope journalists won't normalize Trump's behavior, and there's been a lot to be incredibly concerned about. Who knows what his behavior will be going forward? But you've already started to see, and I'm wondering if this has changed at all on cable networks. Well, I guess Americans just wanted a change narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, we have to walk a careful line here. He is going to be the president. He's the president-elect right now, and that has to be respected, duly respected. And at the same time, I don't think we should act as if there's nothing unusual here, nothing to really remember or focus on. I think it's one thing to have an open mind, and it's another thing to have a clean slate. I don't think we should actually forget all the extremely hateful things that came out of this campaign. I don't think we just go forward as if this never came about. And now we're starting to see some of his appointments, the most troubling one of which to me is Steve Bannon, who has mm-hmm. just been appointed his chief strategist, who's, you know, been known as someone who has this website called Breitbart News, which has promoted some very troubling, very damaging kinds of sentiments on it. And I think we have to be aware and remind people and, you know, tell it straight.
And in terms of covering better those people who voted for him, what responsibility does the press have, and what do places like the Post and all organizations need to do better to understand what ails a significant number of Americans?
Right. I mean, there's a large group of Americans who really have been left behind by the recovery from the last recession. They did not recover. You know, people who work in heavy industry, people who are in the Rust Belt. It's not a country that's thriving from their point of view. And while I think we did stories about these areas of the country, whether it was Appalachia or the Rust Belt, and again, I'm from Buffalo. I grew up in a town called Lackawanna, and I know what this is about. But, you know, we went to these places and we did stories, but I don't think we took it seriously enough or listened hard enough. And that's something that has to be rectified.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has sued the New York Times frequently. He's sued other places. You say that owners of news organizations have to be willing, and I assume many are, to finance court battles. It seems very likely to be necessary in the months and years ahead. Can you sue organizations if you're president? Can you sue? Can you sue the press? Can you sue the Washington Post?
You know, there have certainly been legal skirmishes between administrations and newspapers. You know, you can go back to the Pentagon Papers for that. But you know, it may be that news organizations will have to sue the administration for documents and for access. It's very hard to know, but I do think it's going to be a contentious relationship. And Kathleen, as you know, this comes at a time when many media organizations are weakened mm-hmm. because they, you know, their revenue sources are drying up, particularly newspapers. And it's been heartening to me that I've been reading just today about subscriptions to some of the big national newspapers, including my own, The Washington Post, are up, you know, since the election, because people do realize, well, that this may not be a perfect setup, that they recognize that these are institutions that are under attack and they need the support of their readers. So, but it's also very, very true for local papers, and that, I think, actually worries me most.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say how sturdy a document the U.S. Constitution is and whether its crucial First Amendment is any kind of defense against executive power run amok? Are we going to be testing how sturdy the First Amendment is?
Well, no, you know, the president cannot unilaterally change the First Amendment, and I don't mean to suggest that.
Right.
But the First Amendment is just 45 words. A lot of the protections that it gives us have come about through public acceptance and through court battles and through, you know, decisions that are made at the court level. And I think there, that's going to be where the rubber hits the road. So, you know, with the contentious nature of the relationship between the press and Donald Trump. And of course, as we know, the First Amendment isn't just about press rights. It's also about the, you know, the right to worship as we see fit and the right to assemble. And all of these things, certainly during the campaign, came under fire. So, you know, I hope that people are ready, willing, and able to defend the rights that actually make America what it is. And for me, those are the things that make America great, if we insist on using that formulation, that it's really the First Amendment that helps make America so great, which it is.
Let's take phone calls. We have all four lines going for you, and here's how you reach us when there are free lines, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at Kay Dunn Show. Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for The Washington Post, is our guest, and let's start with Walter in Colby. Hi, Walter.
Yeah, as far as the media is concerned, during the whole campaign and or for the last 18 months, I just feel it's been over-dramatized, and apparently that's what the American public wants, is dramatization. Look at all your TV shows there on TV. But anyway, then you mentioned before about telling the whole story. Well, during the debates, everybody talks about the wall being put up or the border down by Mexico, what have you, and or the immigrants coming in. And then on the next bite, they talk about the economy. Well, why don't you guys tell everybody that it would strengthen the United States economy if all these immigrants weren't shipping back 75 to probably 90% of their income that they make here, and if they were spending it here, the United States would have a stronger economy?
Why don't you tell everybody, Margaret?
Okay. Colby, thank you. That's you raised some really interesting points there. And I should have mentioned when I was talking about the campaign coverage that, as you say, some of the cable TV networks, I think, were really at fault, especially early in the campaign, for some of their practices, the kind of unfiltered access that they got, that they gave to Donald Trump, the way that they had these campaign surrogates who often didn't add much to the discussion. I mean, there's a lot there that didn't go particularly well. In terms of, digging into immigration policy and trade policy, I agree with you that we got too hung up if we can talk about the press generally. We got too hung up on the horse race. Who was winning? Who was up in the polls? Who was saying the most outrageous thing right now? And we didn't dig in as much as we should have to the deeper issues that affect Americans' lives.
Mm. The other thing that he's happened, and it sort of brought to mind Rush Limbaugh and the rise of Rush Limbaugh in radio some years ago, is that we are living in this age where we seem to be seeking out, and there are venues that are popular where people are told what to think, and then you hear the same thing that you heard on the radio from people because Rush told them what to think, or somebody on Fox or somebody on MSNBC, I think, on liberal sources, less so than very conservative. But instead of really digging in and doing investigative journalism, we, for some reason, tell me what it is, Margaret, like to have people do our thinking for us.
Right. There's this sort of rise of, pundits.
Right.
Opinionators. And, really the heart of good journalism is reporting. And it's reporting that really gets at facts and presents them impartially and independently and neutrally. And when there are so many people, and I guess I'm falling into this category myself now, although I didn't always, but I write a column, so now I'm one of these opinion people. But the heart of good journalism is actually deep reporting, and I think that is something that we have to protect and really get back to.
Doug in Reedsburg, hi.
Hi. I had a couple things, but I'm going to try and make it as quick as I can. I think that there's an education gap between where we decide to get our news. Being an educated person, knowing that you have to go through and cite your sources and find good sources and do research and actually have good methods for finding things to have solid research, that may not be the case for what I would call illegitimate news sources. And since news is a method of transmitting information to mass population, that population, depending on their education level, may not know the difference between a legitimate news source and an illegitimate news source and cause a bunch of misinformation in the information age.
Right. I mean, Doug, I couldn't agree with you more. There is an education gap, and there's a real need for, I know this sounds a little boring and a little wonkish, but I feel so strongly about it. There's such a need for news literacy that we have to teach young people and even people who aren't so young how to distinguish between actual news that is based in fact and, you know, comes from a responsible news organization and things that are being made up and transmitted, especially by social media. And the more they're shared, the more they come up before you that supposedly, and this was shared a million times on Facebook, you know, that Pope Francis endorsed Donald Trump.
Right.
And that simply wasn't the case, but the more it was shared, the more you would see it. And there are, you know, we have to bring, I think as Americans, we have to bring a certain amount of critical thinking to this and check and see if this is true in places that we believe. And again, I really feel strongly that we, with the rise of all these fake news sites and all this misinformation shared on social media, we owe it to our young people to actually teach this as a course and a required course in school. I'd love to see that happen.
As a journalist, I want you to comment, because a lot of people are commenting now on the rise of Breitbart News and how it became such a gone-to site during the campaign, incredibly popular, and now you have, in a senior counselor position, very important position, to the President of the United States from Breitbart News.
Well, Breitbart News is one of these fringe right, you know, they call themselves a news organization. I that might be a little too kind. You know, it's part of the whole echo chamber that's going on, in which there are right-wing sites that stir up all kinds of things. There are left-wing sites that repeat each other, and we as a population, I think, have kind of retreated into our corners.
Right.
It all started, I think, with Fox News, which presented itself as an alternative to the, you know, sort of elite left-wing media, and Breitbart certainly is far to the right of Fox.
So what about all that? What are the consequences of that?
Well, the consequences are that sometimes people are believing things that aren't true. And, you know, I'm a true believer in the role of good journalism. I mean, this is something that I hold very dear. I think we have to really double down and do our jobs better than ever. And that means making sure we're fair, making sure we are truly neutral, and covering everyone in America, not just the people that we talk to all the time. We have to do better with that. But I don't think we should be beating ourselves up so much about it that we cower. We can't cower here. We actually have to be pretty brave.
Thanks, Doug. Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess when I followed the campaign, I felt that the media in general was very much biased towards Hillary Clinton. And in fact, in a lot of ways, didn't report or vet her appropriately on her campaign and how the DNC, was unfair for Bernie Sanders, as well as the Clinton emails, as well as the Clinton Foundation. And that by not vetting her appropriately, when they appropriately vetted Donald Trump and the things that he said, and he would claim media bias, that it made that claim seem real and the claims against him less real. And so I was just hoping for your guest to comment on how is it that, you know, things are not covered equally between the two candidates, and that why there is a real bias towards the left by the media.
All right. Thanks, Charlie.
Charlie, thank you. That's a question that, you know, certainly hurt a lot, and there is some validity to it. I think one of the reasons that we were covering Trump so heavily was that he is such this is kind of a euphemism, but he's kind of such an unusual candidate, and the things he was saying were so outside the bounds, and his background also, you know, there's a lot in it to dig into. He had never run for public office before, whereas Hillary Clinton had been in the public eye for a long time. She'd run for president before. She'd been quite thoroughly vetted. In terms of her, the email controversy, I always like to remind people that it was the New York Times, which people think of as, you know, such a so deep into the pocket of the Democratic Party. It was the New York Times that broke that story. It was the New York Times that developed that story. The Washington Post did great stories about Bill Clinton and how he was benefiting personally from the connections at the Clinton Foundation. So I really think those stories were there. At the same time, I don't disagree with you that we appeared to be favoring as a whole, you know, if you can even make that kind of a judgment, that I can understand why people would say that we appeared to be favoring Hillary Clinton. And that's something that a lot of people are still pretty upset about. But I do think that we covered those stories, just maybe not to the extent. And then there's this whole argument. Sorry, I don't want to get too complicated.
Sorry.
But there's whole argument about, isn't that false equivalency? When you take the things that Clinton said and did and you compare them to Donald Trump's statements, his background, his bankruptcies, his history and his family history of racial discrimination in their properties, all of that, as opposed to an email server, are we really supposed to equate those things? A lot of people would say that to equate them is actually making them falsely equal. I mean, we can't be sort of doing, well, we've done four negative stories here, now we must do four negative stories there. So there's a question of editorial judgment there, and that's an imperfect science, I'm afraid.
One more phone call for Margaret, then we're same topic, different guest. Annie in Watertown. Hi, Annie.
Hi. I just really have a hard time with that the media is left. The radical right-wing ideology is so accepted as normal, where the mainstream left is not even given coverage. We don't hear anything about that. The people that were the big Trump supporters around here were not hurting for jobs. It's basically anti-Obama, anti-woman. The right-wing radio mentality is totally accepted. And, it shows that the so-called progressive radio station, the only place where you could hear things, in the day after the election, it went to Christmas music. So there is no longer any progressive radio anywhere here.
So, Annie, I think that you make a good point that the progressive left, and if that were represented by Bernie Sanders in the, before the nominations, those voices were definitely not heard as strongly. And, a lot of people feel, and I think there's some validity to this, that the Sanders campaign was not taken very seriously, despite the passion that those people had. Now, I've heard people say if Sanders had been the nominee, he could have gone up better against Trump. Well, we'll never know that. We'll never know what would have come out in that race. But I don't disagree with you that a lot of the following that Trump attracted, did have a misogynist and in some cases, unfortunately, racist tone to it. And that's awful. But some of it was driven by economics, and that's the part of it that I think we have to take very, very seriously.
Absolutely.
Well, there's no access to a progressive voice.
Well, no, certainly
Bernie
there is.
Bernie Sanders was well known to people who listen to the progressive radio here, and that's why he had a lot of support in Wisconsin. But, now that radio station just disappeared.
Well, all right, then let me suggest to you that you consider a subscription to a digital subscription to a newspaper like the Times or the Post. And I think you'd at least be able to hear some voices there that would resonate with you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Annie. And thank you, Margaret Kate. I don't know what your middle name is, but you could change your middle name. Thank you, Margaret.
Right. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, we liked having you, and I hope you'll be with us again soon. Margaret Sullivan, our guest this first half of the show, media columnist for The Washington Post. She was also the New York Times public editor, and she was the chief editor of the Buffalo News. And here's a word of encouragement. Her resume is, for those of you who are starting out, her hometown paper, Buffalo News, where she started as a summer intern. It can happen. See? Good things can happen. We're going to continue. We have another guest coming up who wrote a very interesting reflective piece. He started thinking about the way he covers elections and maybe branching out to hear from people he normally would not have he would not have been listening to as a result of the 2004 presidential election. So we'll meet him in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Roy Peter Clark is with us now. He served at the Poynter Institute for some time. He's the first full-time faculty member, dean, vice president, senior scholar. He contributes to Poynter.org on all kinds of topics: writing, reporting, coaching writers, reading, language, politics, American culture, ethics, and the standards and practices of journalism. He is the author or editor of 18 books, including The Glamour of Grammar. He wrote a piece that we thought was fascinating, Confessions of an Alienated Journalist, and we'll talk about that and how the election of 2004 may have changed the way that he listens to people or broadened the number of people that he listens to. We will continue taking phone calls if you're on hold, as many of you are at the moment. Please just stay where you are, and I promise you we'll be with you in just a little while. And thank you, Roy, for being with us. Hi.
Kathleen, thanks for your hospitality.
Yeah, my pleasure. So let's go back to 2004. You start your article by saying, reading your old stuff does more than bring back memories. It reveals a map of the path that you have traveled. And the election of 2004, what you wrote after that is phenomenally interesting because it kind of changed who you were listening to.
Yeah, it's, I stood in line for 2 hours to vote back in 2004. And I was pretty confident that John Kerry was going to be the president. He was going to defeat George W. Bush. And when he didn't, I was just sort of scratching my head, you know. I used the word alienated, but I'm not even sure that that makes sense, because we kind of recognize the alien in our midst, you know. But I kind of thought that I just didn't. It's as if I existed in a sort of a different country than the one that elected George Bush. And I have to say that that was, 12 years ago, and that feeling came back to me like, I don't know, what do they call it when you have like LSD when you're in the 60s?
I didn't take it. I don't know.
Neither did I. But, you know, right. like a flashback.
Okay. and you discovered more than a decade later after you wrote that Jeb Bush had read the article in the New York Times, and he liked it. And he gave you some, Jeb Bush had you thinking about different things, right?
Well, Jeb Bush had read the article at the time, and he didn't tell me, but he told a political reporter how much he admired the piece and how much it corresponded to his own feelings that journalists were disconnected in a serious way, in a cultural way, in a religious way, for the people who went to church every Sunday, for the people who were really worried about the degrading of values in popular media, you know, and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to say that in revisiting that piece and sort of dusting it off a little bit, I'm saying to myself, I wonder what Jeb Bush thinks now about all the churched people who voted for Donald Trump.
Right.
And whether or not any of the old norms that we accepted as kind of appropriate social, political, journalistic, whatever they may be, it's hard to know what's left standing and what's in ruins.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you write about in your piece, you talk about we need to focus on tolerance, empathy, attention, and self-doubt. Let's talk about this idea, because I think that journalists are having a very hard time giving credence and maybe giving an understanding, but this whole idea of trying to understand some of the hateful rhetoric that came out of this campaign, truly, as you write about them, marginal or dangerous ideas, some things that are hard to embrace in a democracy. How do you deal with that as a fair-minded journalist? Do you deal with people's angst that maybe you overlook, that they, a lot of people are hurting economically? How do you deal with the charges of sexual predatory behavior,
yeah,
of racism, of saying things about Mexicans? What do you do with all of that as a journalist? How are you tolerant of all of that?
You know, I've been looking for stories to tell myself or to revisit that will help me find, a lens, a pair of glasses where I can see things more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with like one of the oldest stories that I know, and one of my favorite stories of all time. And
oh,
I don't mean this. Well, you know, it's the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
And what's interesting about that story, which is only about 125 words long, is that when the lawyer asked Jesus, well, who is my neighbor? You know, be good to your neighbor, love your neighbor, but who is my neighbor? He tells him a story about a man who in those times would have been considered by the lawyer to be one of the most despised people on the face of the earth. The Samaritan, the marginalized, despised outcast. And so we have in that story a kind of a lesson about what it means to sort of have a shared humanity and to be able to look across difference.
Mm-hmm.
My mentor was a man named Gene Patterson, who was the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution from 1960 to 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a signed column on the editorial page every single day for 8 years.
Wow.
And imagine what was happening in Atlanta during that particular time. And so he was and he understood. He had sympathy for the Southern, the traditional Southern agony, if you want to call it that. And yet he understood the need for progress. And one of the things he did in his writing and reporting is that he looked for any example of someone who was willing to cross over some boundary in order to find some either shared humanity or some shared sense of decency. When churches were burned and synagogues were burned in Georgia, he would write editorials saying, whatever you think about segregation, I know you think it's wrong to burn another man's church. And he tried to establish in his own way the common ground that very much led to the dismantling of segregation and the American apartheid system as it existed in the South. And it wasn't that long ago that in South Africa, I visited South Africa in 1994, right after the elections, and who could find two more hateful and antagonistic groups, enemies, you know, in that country, who were able to sometimes, through a system of reconciliation, try to find and identify their common interest and common humanity. So that's the way I'm trying to kind of encourage myself and share with other journalists and students how journalists might be able to look at the next 4 years.
Mm. And do you tell your students that they need to, as you did after 2004, practice some new behaviors, that you need to start listening to maybe different radio stations or going to churches that you normally wouldn't go to, that you need to listen to people in very poor parts of the country who are having a hard time mm-hmm. putting food on the table. What kind of behaviors do journalists need now?
I think, yeah, I was, when I made an inventory, when I made an inventory of my actual behaviors, can I read a quick little list?
So please, this is back then. Please do. Yeah.
I said, I was not blaming anybody else. I was looking myself in the mirror, and I said, I don't know the difference between evangelical and charismatic, but I can argue who has the best videos, Brittany or Christina, you know? I know little about born-again experience, but I can celebrate the narrative structure of the old TV show Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I've never listened to a religious radio program or attended a church supper, but I can tell you whatever you want to know about Howard Stern and a local shock jock named Bubba the Love Sponge. So I kept saying, oh, my God, you know, this is, you know, we've met the enemy, and it's us. It's me. And let me say, since that time, I think that the forces, what are they, gravitational or inertial? I'm not a physicist. But the forces that drive us or pull us back, let's say, into the echo chamber, into the social media groups in which we can hear expressions of ideas and opinions that confirm our own biases, that I think these forces have increased. So trying to achieve escape velocity from those, where you can experience the other in whatever form that takes, is, I think, increasingly important. Now, I think there's another intellectual capacity that I think is more important than ever. I went to graduate school at the State University of New York out on Long Island at Stony Brook. Mm-hmm. It's a big university. And in the last decade, they've run thousands and thousands of students through courses on what they call news literacy. And these are the ability to not be victimized by fake news, the ability to see, to evaluate different sources of information, the ability to distinguish journalism from other expressions of the media. These capacities, I think, are more important than ever, and they are being introduced in some elementary and middle school programs, but more in high school and college, and I think we need more of that than ever.
Absolutely. We're also, though, living in a world, and I'm sure that you were disturbed by the way the press was treated, particularly in the Trump campaign, where news operations were banned from covering, where protesters were heckling those who were in this caged-off area where the candidate would call out certain reporters and talk about, you know, how awful the press was. The world in which, as our first guest this hour was talking about, people wear T-shirts that read "Tree Rope Journalists, Some Assembly Required," which was seen at a lot of rallies. How do you deal with that? I mean, what do you do about that, Roy?
So, we had a remarkable experience at Poynter last week, and I was happy, proud to be in charge of a visiting group of about 100 journalists from 50 some odd countries who were sponsored by the State Department. They were here as Edward R. Murrow Fellows. They were chosen competitively from across the globe. And what an amazing experience to be with journalists from 50 different countries 2 or 3 days after this presidential election and to talk to them about the mission and purpose of journalism. Dan Rather came to this event and spoke to them as well and reflected on it. And what was very interesting is that it put American journalists' challenges and problems in some perspective. When you're with groups of journalists who, a large group of journalists, many, many of whom had been either imprisoned or beaten or held against their will, who live in countries where they're constantly under attack, where they have a true target on their backs.
Yes.
So I think what we came out of that with is that journalism has always been a risky business. And from the time that that foreign correspondents and war correspondents, Edward R. Murrow went on 25 bombing runs with the British Air Force. So I think what we need is I think what will happen is that journalists will kind of gather their forces. They will recommit to a sense of mission and purpose. They will, I hope, be in doing that, be do it with humility and with openness and tolerance and a willingness to learn new things,
mm-hmm.
but also encourage support of journalism, since journalism has been, I think Jay Rosen used the word, you know, so decertified by a variety of forces within within the culture. I thought it was interesting, for example, that subscriptions of certain newspapers apparently have gone up in the last couple of years.
Yes. And since the election, too.
Yeah. And so if a collateral benefit of this confusion that we're going through is more literacy, is more education, is more attention to all of the fact-checking that's going on, that has become part of a sort of a revolutionary movement across the globe in journalism,
mm-hmm.
I think all of those are really good things.
Let's get a phone call for you in just a moment. Roy Peter Clark has been with the Poynter Institute for some time. He contributes to Poynter.org on a variety of issues pertinent to our conversation today. He is the first full-time faculty member there, dean, vice president, senior scholar. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, okay, that's talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Roy Peter Clark. Audrey in Madison, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm very impressed with your guest's intelligence. But I, as an American citizen, am very disappointed that nowhere that I know of on the 5 o'clock or 10 o'clock news was the issue that we are having standoffs in both the China Sea and the Syrian Sea with Russia and China, at which Putin gave several talks, and I saw them and followed them very closely, where he was saying, we do not, Russia and America's values are very closely aligned. We do not want war with America.
Mm. Well, and let's take the press part of that question, that there is, and you can tell us statistics about this, when you look at international coverage, so many places have cut their budgets. There isn't very much coverage of what she's talking about.
Audrey makes a sound point, and she's a good citizen if she's following international policy in that detail, and I applaud her for that. It's true, there's been a retreat from international news. The economic model that sustained journalism, especially in newspapering, for so long has collapsed. I think that collapse has been felt in some respects, more in the middle of the country than on the coasts. In places like Louisville and Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Detroit, and Des Moines, there are still good newspapers there, but they were once they had many, many more resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of wondering whether, for example, in Louisville back in the day, there was no way that the country could avoid paying attention to the plight of the coal miners. And so I'm just wondering if part of our problem is the loss of news resources as a result of a technological and informational revolution that we haven't seen since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, we better figure that out because we keep going in that direction. If we're not going to be informed, we need to make sure that we're informed if we're going more digital.
Absolutely. And, you know, you go to you look at state houses. I live in Florida, which is has been a very vigorous newspaper and journalistic state. And the number of reporters who were covering state government in Tallahassee was once significant. All the papers had bureaus.
Right.
And they've disappeared. A lot of those reporters are no longer being watchdogs for those in power. And that's and listen, all you have to do is listen to the BBC News to understand how underrepresented international news is by American news media.
Mm-hmm. Audrey, thanks for the call. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi, Jim. The one thing I want to get your guest reaction to is that during the campaign, it was never really covered how deeply flawed a candidate Hillary Clinton was. Trump on the right and Sanders on the left both represented an anti-establishment populist theme. Hillary had no resonance or meaning in her campaign. And while I agree with the guest comments that Trump reminds me of Huey Long, but Hillary had a lot of Marie Antoinette in her. And the bottom line is, in 2004, George Bush beat John Kerry because George Bush went to Philip Vandover, but he never talked like it. Well, John Kerry could never get St. Paul Preppy out of his mouth. I'll be interested in your guest response.
All right, thanks, Rory.
Yeah, listen, people who supported Hillary Clinton could point to many cases in news coverage where her flaws were reported. I think it's hard to. I know in the last issue you talk about the issue of sort of equivalency, true equivalency or false equivalency, and I think that Trump's issues or problems. They were more manifest. They lent themselves to more sensationalist coverage. Hillary Clinton's one of her great flaws, in my opinion, as someone who voted for her, if I may say that, is secretiveness and a kind of unapproachability, both in terms of press coverage, but also in terms of sort of establishing some kind of a personal connection with the voters. I think that, you know, back in the day when Senator Joseph McCarthy represented, do you remember which state that was?
Yes, I remember pretty well. Wisconsin.
It was Wisconsin.
It was Wisconsin, right?
Who was the other senator? Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, Bob La Falla was from the left much earlier on, the head of the progressive movement. So we produced both in this state. Right.
Exactly. And that's and so to the extent that Trump's kind of personal outrageousness and populism created a larger sort of posture, both for coverage. Think of all the coverage he got all the way through, more than some people think he deserved. And at the same token, you know, it was he became a target for certain kinds of important investigations.
Yeah. Well, darn, I hate to take, well, we did better not. If I take another call, we'll run out of time, and that's the way it goes. Well, Roy, carry on. It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, what happens in terms of how the American public respects the press and the president respects the press and suits that may take place. We're in new ground here, I think.
So can I offer your listeners this kind of one quick idea?
Yeah.
And that is that I hope that all of us have enough confidence in our ideas and also enough moral courage to be able to expose ourselves to ideas which are significantly different from our own.
And on that, we say fare thee well and thank you. Roy Peter Clark from the Poynter Institute. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We're with you again tomorrow. We're going to do something humorous, hour two of our program, so stay tuned for some laughs.